It's The Splendid Table from 8 p.m. American Public Media. I'm David Leet, in this week for Lynn Rosetto Casper. He was in the middle of a hectic book tour, but the memoirist Augustine Burroughs carved out some time to sit down with me to discuss his new book, Lust and Wonder.
Cooking is similar to reading for me. I didn't read a book until I was 24, and it's not because I couldn't read. It's because to read, you need peace and silence and space physically and, you know, sort of psychologically. And it's the same with cooking. I mean, much of my life has been about triage, you know, and putting out sort of these emotional and psychological fires. But, you know, it's not like that now. It really isn't. I'm in a much better, happier place, so there's time to let bread rise.
That's Augustine Burroughs on Lust and Wonder and how he came to embrace happiness and cooking. And the Piechiatrist is in. Kate McDermott will quell all your anxieties about making the perfect pie crust. She'll be answering your questions from social media, so don't go anywhere. I know I won't. This is The Splendid Table from 8 p.m. American Public Media. The show about life's appetites. I'm David Leet, in this week for Lynn Rosetto Casper. Now, if you're wondering, hey, who is this David Leet? Well, let me introduce myself. I'm a food writer, cookbook author, and for the past 17 years, the publisher of the website Leet's Culinaria. And The Splendid Table and I go way back, all the way to 2003 when I read an essay for the first time on the show. And for those of you who don't know me, well, it's nice to meet you. We learned about his dysfunctional family and, I think it's fair to say it, bizarre upbringing in the runaway hit Running with Scissors. Augustine Burroughs followed that up with memoirs about getting sober and also navigating the rough waters of his relationship with his father. Now, in his latest book, Lust and Wonder, he tackles love in all its strange and inexplicable incarnations and opens up about embracing cooking. Welcome to the show, Augustine.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And congratulations on the book. It's fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Now, for those people who have not yet read it, like I have, can you just briefly sum it up for us?
Sure. It's Lust and Wonder, and it's a memoir. It's really a love story, is how I think of it. Mm. It's a love story, but you've got to, you know, crawl through some broken glass for a little bit first
before you get to
the love. Yeah. And it's also about the period of my life where I've been sober. I've been sober since 1999. So this is sort of a follow-up, if you will, to my previous memoir, Dry, about my experience with being an alcoholic, working in advertising. So this is what my life has been like without struggling with addiction and how I made kind of more of a mess of my life than I ever did before. So,
and you talk about this as the third installment of your trilogy of memoirs with Running with Scissors, Dry, and now Lust and Wonder. And I'm curious, how do you see some of the themes that you began years ago work themselves through the different memoirs? How are they the same and how are they different?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I didn't really think of it as a trilogy until after the fact, but mm-hmm. it, clearly to me it is. And you know, my first memoir was Running with Scissors, about growing up with my mentally ill mother and alcoholic father's lunatic psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. In his house with a bunch of family members and long-term psychiatric patients. And that was a world where there were no rules, there was no structure. You know, there was a lot of sort of abuse going on in that crazy world. And I think that mm-hmm. experience, it honed my sense of humor for sure, because it was so awful that, you know, you've either got to find the humor in it or just check out.
Exactly.
But it also gave me, you know, there was no stability. So finding security and stability and predictability was something that, you know, was very important to me in much of Lust and Wonder, you know, and I made a lot of, you know, really dubious choices because of that search for stability and a guarantee. But, you know, there really are no guarantees in life. And, you know, one of the things I think that's featured in the book a lot as well is I started to doubt my own instinct, my gut instinct, and mm-hmm. that really was, there was a heavy penalty for that.
And I thought, what was really wonderful about the book is it's much more contemplative and thoughtful, I think, than some of the other books. And it was there was a collective breath all readers have had when they got to that point and they realized, oh, he's going to be okay. He's going to make it through all of this and he's going to be okay. And I think your insights on relationships, especially long-term relationships, I thought were very keen and very spot on.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I mean, I was thinking a lot about, you know, compromise. I was in a relationship for almost 10 years with someone named Dennis. And, you know, I don't think either of us were fully content and happy. But I kept telling myself, well, this is, you know, relationship experts and, you know, television and magazines all say, you know, compromise is part of a relationship. But how much compromise? You know, so that's something I was thinking about a lot. And how much compromise was I willing to tolerate? And how much compromise, you know, ought a person to tolerate? When is it too much?
Speaking of Dennis, there is a hilarious section about Thanksgiving at his house. And you say in the book that cooking is his way of showing his love to you.
Right.
But you also say that he used it as a weapon. He withheld food. He didn't cook for you. And he used it as a controlling point. Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic of food in your relationship with Dennis?
Well, you know, there was it really is like you just explained so beautifully. There, he was a very ambitious cook, you know, and he loved to experiment and make very complicated meals. But when things were not going well between us, you know, he would always sort of make something that he knew I was not going to like. You know, maybe from my list of foods that I won't eat or don't like. You know. Or he would not make anything, and it would just be, you know, a very sort of sterile evening. And it was, I think, because we had major communication problems. He had a really difficult time talking to me about what he was feeling and expressing any anger at all. He did not like any sort of conflict, and he didn't like to express, you know, discomfort or displeasure. So he would act out, you know, I think, in other ways. And certainly, you know, the preparation of food was one of those many ways.
And speaking about holidays and Thanksgiving and being at the table, I'm sure you must have quite a collection of memories of things that happen around the dinner table on holidays. Any of that pop up?
Mm-hmm. You know, in my early childhood, when it was just, you know, living with my parents in Western Massachusetts, holidays were sort of a somber affair. I mean, they were performed ritualistically, and the foods that were prepared, my parents were both Southern. So, you know, there was an element of, you know, things were ported from cans, you know, mixed together. And hams were from a can, and they were, you know, scored with a knife, and then cloves were inserted. But there were not, these were joyless occasions, you know. They were just sort of ritualistically performed. And then when I was growing up in the psychiatrist's house with his family, holidays were a lot more fun, but they were also a lot crazier, you know. And so many, many people dropped by. It was like a train station, and it was messy and disorganized and crazy. But it was, you know, there was a lot more sort of love, I think, there. And my holidays over the past few years have been really, really great and unusual, too, you know. And I have cooked more than I ever did.
Do you enjoy cooking?
Which, you know, I do, you know, I really do. And one thing I have really been enjoying lately, of all things, is making pine needle and rosemary bread, because we have a lot of pine needles, white pine, on the property. And so pine needle and rosemary bread is a thing that goes together really well.
And have you found that your embracing of cooking goes along with your journey of sort of becoming more settled with yourself?
Absolutely. I'm not, you know, in sort of crisis mode at all times. I mean, this is really, cooking is similar to reading for me. I didn't read a book until I was 24. And it's not because I couldn't read. It's because to read, you need peace and silence and space physically and, you know, sort of psychologically. And it's the same with cooking. I mean, much of my life has been about triage, you know, and putting out sort of these emotional and psychological fires.
Right.
But, you know, it's not like that now. It really isn't. I'm in a much better, happier place, so there's time to let bread rise.
Augustine, it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Augustine Burroughs is the author of 6 New York Times bestselling memoirs. His latest is Lust and Wonder. And if you head to the website, you can listen to my extended conversation with Augustine and hear him read a hilarious Thanksgiving scene from the book. You know where to go. SplendidTable.org. And I hope you'll join me when I host again for my next book chat, when I talk to Diane Abu-Jaber, author of Life Without a Recipe. So pick up your copy and read along with me. The art of food preservation is about much more than just produce, and few know this as well as the Italians. Cookbook author Domenica Marchetti celebrates Italy's long tradition of putting up food in her new book, Preserving Italy. Splendid Table contributor Shauna Seaver spoke to Domenica from New York City.
Hi, Domenica. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Shauna. It's nice to be here.
You talk about the deep connection between the art of preserving and Italian history and culture. And I grew up with a grandfather who is half Greek, half Italian. He put up vegetables and fruits like you wouldn't believe all summer long. So did his mother, who was from Italy. And it didn't occur to me as a kid growing up in the Chicago suburbs, watching him religiously can everything, until I was reading your book that that practice is probably deeply tied to his Italian heritage. And it made me wonder, what is it about Italy that creates that strong tradition of preserving food?
Yeah, you know, Italy is the kind of place where if there is a plot of land, somebody is growing something in it. And, you know, it's the climate and the fact that so many things grow well and that people are used to growing their own food. So I think these traditions still carry on today. Obviously, life has changed and people buy convenience foods. But I think these traditions are still held dear to many folks in Italy.
You go beyond the produce, too, though. You talk about fresh cheeses and cured meats.
Yeah, I took a very broad view of what preserving is. So, yes, there are vegetables preserved in oil and vinegar. There are jams and fruit pastes. There are condiments. But there are also fresh cheeses, salumi. You know, a lot of people think of Italian cooking as spaghetti or pizza or gelato. And, of course, those are all iconic, wonderful Italian foods, but the Italian table is composed of so much more, and a lot of what it's composed of is preserved food. Obviously, this was something that was created out of necessity centuries ago, but these traditions, you know, continue. So when you go to a restaurant in Italy, you'll have fresh house-made cheese or the cheese that came from the, you know, the Casificio, the dairy down the road. You'll have house-made salumi. In Abruzzo, you will have hot peppers preserved in any number of ways, in oil or vinegar or dried and crushed. You know, there's always some kind of a choice at the table because we Abruzzese like spicy food. At the end of the meal, you'll be treated to house-made liqueurs. So everything from the beginning of the meal to the end of the meal really does contain food that is preserved.
I was surprised to learn about how so many preserved foods are so much more than just condiments. Now, some of these recipes can really become the star of the meal and be the thing that really get people talking at the table.
Yeah, there really is a whole spectrum. And I'm thinking of one in particular. You know, I talked about how preserving is pretty much a celebration of frugality and something that was born out of necessity. But right now I'm thinking of one of the condiments in the book, mostarda, which comes from the Lombardy region. It's fruit mustard. And what it is basically whole fruits or pieces of fruits that are poached in sugar syrup over a number of days and then spiked with very, very spicy mustard oil. So this is kind of the opposite of frugality. This recipe, I think, dates back to medieval times, and it is an accompaniment to roasts. And you can almost see it like on the table at, you know, in a Game of Thrones episode. It's that kind of very rich, sumptuous condiment that was not born out of necessity, but something that was reserved for nobility. But it persists to this day, and you can still go to these places in Cremona and other parts of Lombardy and see these jars of mostarda, and you can buy it. And I wanted to create real mostarda for the book. I had a hard time finding very small fruits, which is what are used to preserve whole. So I ended up doing something a little different, and I sliced pears and I poached them in this sugar syrup over a few days, and they become candied. And and then at the very end, I spiked it with this very, very, very hot mustard oil. And not only is it a great condiment for roasts or boiled meats, it's kind of like a counter to the rich, fatty meat, but it's also great with rich cheeses. So it's, you know, it's nice that you can take these old traditions and kind of reinvent them, you know, in contemporary cooking.
Thank you so much, Domenica.
Thanks for having me.
Domenica Marchetti is the author of 6 books on Italian cooking. Her latest is Preserving Italy. Contributor Shauna Seaver is the author of Real Sweet. Head to splendidtable.org to find Domenica's recipe for pear mostarda. And while you're there, be sure to register for our June giveaway. This month, we're giving away 14 Zwilling Pro 3-piece starter knife sets. And don't miss the last installment of our video series, The Splendid Table Cooks with Francis Lamb. We've saved the best for last for you. This week, Francis walks us through his famous weapons-grade ratatouille. It's all there at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the Pie-chiatrist is in. I'm David Leet, in for the silver-throated Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm David Leet, in for Lynn Rossetto Casper this week. Food wasn't exactly Virgilio Martinez's first love. A former national skateboarding champion in his native Peru, Martinez decided to ditch the board in favor of the bar and studied law. Then, while off on holiday, he discovered his love of cooking. And after cooking his way around the world, Martinez returned home, where he opened his much-lauded restaurant, Central, in the Peruvian capital of Lima. Contributor Noel Carter sat down with him to discuss all things Peruvian.
Virgilio, your cookbook Lima is such a beautiful cookbook. I love how you write in the introduction that the dishes in the cookbook are not about traditional Peruvian cuisine, but flavors and memories from a contemporary perspective.
Yeah, that's important to acknowledge that always modern cuisine has to be somehow inspired by our heritage, the Incas food. So we maintain our classical dishes, like ceviches, causas, anticuchos, which right. actually are the dishes that we are serving in the restaurant we have here in London. But we do a little twist to adapt to different palates. We're cooking for many, many people in the world, so things have to change. And, of course, people is changing, life is changing, and our recipes, they got to change.
Right. You know, for so many chefs, food is about a sense of place, and the cuisine is defined by the local terroir. How does your cooking in Peru vary from cooking in London, and how do the seasons and availability of local ingredients influence your cooking at each of the restaurants?
Yeah, Central in Lima, Peru, and Lima in London, actually they work differently. What I do in Peru is a food based on biodiversity, and we use actually 100% of Peruvian products. Of course, we cannot that here in London. So maybe we use probably 15% of Peruvian products in London, and the rest are coming from seasonalities in Europe, in the UK. And then in Central, we do just tasting menus, what is actually more like a fine dining structure. And here in London, we are more casual, more straight to Peruvian cuisine, because we have to start from scratch, from what's Peruvian cuisine, and how can we think about what's the evolution of Peruvian cuisine in the next 5 years.
You mentioned ceviches, and you devote an entire section of your book to ceviches. Why is it so integral to Peruvian cuisine? And what are some of the central rules to making it?
You know, ceviche has been done by the Incas a long time ago. And we didn't realize it was so good for us until the Japanese came to Peru. You know, Peruvian cuisine is a mix of Chinese, Japanese, Incas, Spanish, Italians. And, well, actually, when the Japanese came maybe 150 years ago, they taught us how to, you know, preserve the fish, treat the fish well. So the ceviche started to evolve, yeah? And nowadays it's a very iconic dish. I was amazed because when Peruvian cuisine wasn't known at all, we had Nobu doing ceviches in California, in Los Angeles, of course, and we had Daniel Bolu doing ceviches in New York. But for us, it's kind of a comfort food. So I think this is the time to show our comfort food and how can it be evolved in time.
One of the things I found most fascinating is when we think of ceviche, we may often think of it as being a fish-based dish. But I love that you include all of these alternative vegetable options, baby corn ceviche, zucchini and carrot, and you even have a quinoa ceviche with avocado. How did you come up with these recipes?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it's very classic to do a ceviche with fish, white fish, actually. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, since we have some issues with fish and we are eating more vegetables and we are looking for new ingredients, so we came with the idea of using the tiger's milk, which is a liquid that marinates the fish. That liquid is a mix of celery, ginger, garlic, onions, lime juice, coriander, and chili peppers, and ice. So it's actually a juice. And that is going to marinate the fish. Then we came with the idea of using the same tiger's milk to dress asparagus, quinoas, avocados. So we are now doing vegetarian ceviches. We do ceviches with fruits. It goes beyond the fish.
Fascinating. You know, it's funny. You've written about food not being the first passion in your life. You were a national skateboarding champion, and then you studied law, and then you got into cooking. What was it that sparked your interest in cooking?
I think I've always cooked, but I didn't know I was going to become a chef, you know, like I had no idea about restaurants. But when I used to do skateboarding, I was cooking at home. I was seeing my grandmother cooking. And then actually I dropped law school because of my passion about cooking. So, and then I think it all made sense when I started to travel. And I went to Singapore, Madrid, New York, London, and I realized that we have to travel. As a cook, we have to travel to understand different cultures, to see people, to see food, to understand flavors and new ingredients. I think this is always a message for young chefs that when you travel the world, you kind of never forget where you're coming from. So I was always traveling as a Peruvian guy, as a Peruvian cook. So when I came back to Peru, I had all this discipline, all this knowledge, and I can do that in my cuisine. So using local ingredients, but with a very global way of think.
It's beautiful. Virgilio, it's such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Chef Virgilio Martinez has restaurants in Lima and London. He's the author of Lima, the Cookbook, Peruvian Home Cooking. To find Virgilio's recipes for arroz chufa vegetal, you gotta forgive me, that's my Portuguese accent going on there, but that's rice with lots of vegetables, and pan de cilantro y cebolla morado, that's cilantro and red onion bread, by the way, head to splendidtable.org. Making pie crust is one of those things that can make even good cooks blanch. That's why we invited Kate McDermott, whom I affectionately call the Pikeiatrist, on the show. Kate's the author of the upcoming book, Art of the Pie, which is based upon her philosophy of baking and life. And she's here to talk about making a foolproof pie crust and to take your questions from social media. Kate, welcome to the show.
It is a delight to be here with you.
Well, we received so many requests and questions when we put a shout out that you were going to be on the show. So can I ask you some of them?
Of course.
Okay, good. Julie via Twitter asked, when first forming the pie dough into a disc, how dry or wet should it be? Mine is always crumbly and dry.
This is an excellent question. Julie, I think what you should do is have it so it feels it's a little moist, cool and moist like clay, perhaps. But there are some key things to know. Mm-hmm. I have found that it only takes 4 ingredients in a good dough. You need flour, you need salt, you need some fat, you need some water. You want to keep all your ingredients chilled. Mm-hmm. So when we're putting the water in, for my recipe, which is about 2.5 cups of flour, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, and 8 tablespoons of butter, 8 tablespoons of lard, I'm usually going to be putting in for that much about 8 tablespoons of ice water. But I start first by putting in about 5 tablespoons, and I mix it with a fork. Then, if it's immediately, if it's feeling like, oh, it's starting to get sluggish, the sluggish is what I'm looking for. Usually
for
me,
mean?
I'm taking that fork through all the ingredients in my bowl, and my dough, the dough feels a little heavy as I push it through. And usually what I find is it's going to take me about 8 tablespoons of water. Sometimes it may take me up to 9 or 10 tablespoons of water. Once you have that done, then you want to take a little squeeze of it. Mm-hmm. Can you see an indentation of your fingers in there? Does it fall apart or does it sort of stay together? Then pull it together if it does, then push it together into a big softball. And that should feel cool. It should feel slightly moist, sort of like cool clay.
All right. T. Jones, also from Twitter, asked, what's the right temperature and time for pre-baking crusts?
When you're pre-baking, preheat your oven to 425, put some parchment paper in, and put pie weights in your rolled-out dough, and then you bake for about 20 to 25 minutes at that hot temperature. Pull your weights out and put it back in the oven at 375 for about 6 minutes or so until it gets the right color and dries out a little bit.
All right. Then we have Alexandra, also from Twitter, asks, what kind of pan is worthy of the perfect pie crust?
Alexandra, I use every pan out there. I use ceramic pans, I use metal pans, I use glass pans. You just really need to know the properties of all of them. The glass pans will bake the fastest. The metal pans, you want to make sure that you have one that is not shiny, because shiny will deflect heat. And the ceramic pans, I love their even heat distribution and heat retention. All of them are great, and I use them all. I have 98 pie pans, if you would believe that.
I believe that from you. Here's a great question from Deborah via Facebook. Is all-purpose flour the best for pie crusts?
Yes, all-purpose flour is the best for pie crusts because it has a good ratio and balance of all different flours to give it the right protein content.
Excellent. All right, again, from Facebook, we have Lisa, and she asks, can I use coconut oil in my pie crust?
You can. It has a lower melting point. It will be a little more difficult to deal with, and you will have a coconut flavor in your pie.
Hmm. And we have a question from our editor and technical director, Jennifer Lubke. So, Jen, what's your question?
Yeah, sorry to butt in. I heard you talking about mixing your pie dough with a fork. Is that really the best way to do it? Because I'll admit it, I use a food processor.
Well, I am a make-it-by-hand girl myself because that's how my grandmother taught me. But, yes, you can use a food processor. You just want to be really judicious when you're touching the pulse blade, you know, so that it's breaking up the fat. And once you get it all together, I finish it off by hand, so I put the last little bit of water in there. A true pie geek is going to find that you lose about 3-5% of tenderness on there with a food processor, but that's really just going to be somebody like me or maybe David.
Thank you. Perfect.
A perfect pie crust. Kate, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
Kate McDermott is the author of the upcoming book, Art of the Pie. Now, I got a sneak peek, and I have to tell you, it's a great book, and you're going to love it. And even we at the Splendid Table know that radio has its limitations, so Kate was kind enough to shoot a hands-on video of her perfect pie crust technique. So for more information about Kate and to find her recipe and video tutorial, you know where to go. Come on, say it with me. SplendidTable.org.
Melissa Officinalis, goddess of bees. It's also known by a more familiar name, lemon balm. We're seeing it more and more at farmers' markets lately and also nurseries, but what exactly are we supposed to do with it? Well, Lynn recently caught up with horticulturalist Jekka McVicker, a woman that Chef Jamie Oliver refers to as the Queen of Herbs, to learn more about this often overlooked garden gem.
Jekka, it is so good to have you back with us.
It's lovely to hear you across the pond.
Yes, as they say. I'd like to talk to you about lemon balm. I think this is really a sleeper. People really, I think about it as an herb or even know about it.
I think it's the most fantastic herb. The Latin of it is Melissa officinalis. And Melissa was the goddess of bees and honey. And there's this lovely saying that if you have lemon balm near your hives, you'll never have unhappy bees. But I love lemon balm because it's just been proven, scientifically proven, that it reduces stress. All you have to do is put 5 to 6 leaves in a cup, add boiled water, boiled, please note it says boiled, and leave for about 5 minutes to steep. Strain and drink. It is fantastic, and it relieves tiredness and headaches. And the other marvellous thing about lemon balm is if you've ever suffered from cold sores, all you have to do is make that solution, you know, with the 5 or 6 leaves,
right,
it cool right down, and then put a bit of cotton wool into the lemon balm solution and add that onto your actual cold sore, and it will vanish.
I had no idea.
And the really interesting thing is it's Melissa officinalis, and any plant that has that word officinalis attached to it was used medicinally. So you get the, you know, immediately you hear that, you know, da-da, this is going to be a really interesting herb, and it's full of history.
First of all, it's such a pretty plant.
It looks like mint in a way, doesn't it? It's a member of the mint family. It can be invasive in the garden, so do be careful. It doesn't spread quite like mint does, but it does spread in the garden, and it can self-seed and pop up everywhere. But it's easy to see and it's easy to rip out, so it's really no trouble. My top tip, though, if you're growing it, is to always cut it back after flowering, because like mint, you'll manage to get it to then produce more leaves for you to use.
Ah.
I do let mine flower because I'm so aware of bees, and I do have 4 beehives. If you're cooking, though, you can use it to cover a chicken in the leaves and then tin foil and whack it in the oven like that. And it really infuses the flavour of that lovely lemon into your chicken.
How else would you use it in cooking?
Well, I use it with rhubarb. Do you have rhubarb in the States?
Oh, yes, we have rhubarb.
Do you know what I mean by rhubarb? Okay, right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you cook rhubarb, it makes your mouth dry after.
Oh, yeah.
So if you put a big handful of lemon balm, so what I do is I actually put the stalks as well, and I tie it up with string, and I whack that in. And as I'm stewing my rhubarb, and that removes the tartness and cuts down your sugar by about 50%.
I wish you lived next door. I could just say, come for a cup of tea now. I have only 100 questions today.
It would be lovely.
Jekka, thank you.
Thank you.
Jekka McVicker is a British horticulturalist who's been growing organic herbs for well over 30 years. The Royal Horticultural Society recently named her Ambassador for Health and Well-Being through Gardening. And she's author of The Complete Herb Book and Jekka's Herb Cookbook. For more information about Jekka, hit up our website, splendidtable.org. Up next, one of my favorite segments, Talking to You. While Lynn's out of the office, I am slipping into her chair and answering your questions. And I've got a special guest. Who is it? Well, you're just going to have to wait until after the break to find out. I'm David Leet, in for Lynn Rosetta Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm David Leet, in this week for Lynn. And now it's that time to turn to your calls and questions. You know, you can always send us your splendid table questions via Facebook and Twitter. Or, of course, you can go old school, pick up the phone and call us at 800-537-5252. I have to admit, this is like homecoming for me. My special guest to help answer your questions is Renee Shetler-Rossi, the editor-in-chief of my website, Leeds Culinaria, and my one-time co-host of our podcast, Talking With My Mouthful. Renee, thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's been a long time, hasn't it?
It's been a really long time, but here we are, together again.
Together again, and I'm so glad you're joining me all the way over there from Phoenix. As you know, Renee, my world came crashing down when you announced to me that you were moving from two blocks away from me all the way across the country to Arizona. What's the food scene like down there? I've never been.
Well, it's pretty diverse, actually. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of Tex-Mex and a lot of Mexican out here. There's a lot of barbecue, a lot of really great barbecue.
Yeah.
Every place has tacos. Although I have to say what I was most surprised by is the farmers markets out here. I mean, it's the desert, right? I mean, I didn't expect there to be anything other than chili peppers. But we've got virtually everything I could find at Union Square Farmers Market. In fact, the very first day I came to a farmers market here, I was kind of dreading going. I was afraid I was going to be disappointed. And there I found the gorgeous heirloom Scarlet Queen turnips that I would get every week in Manhattan.
And they're local?
They're local. There's a big urban gardening scene out here. And in fact, we now have a gardening box in our front yard. We've got four in our backyard. I'm putting the back alley into use. We've planted three types of citrus, a Santa Rosa plum tree, and an avocado tree.
Well, now you're just rubbing it in, Renee, that you've gone all the way across the country. There's no reason for you to come back anymore and visit.
Manhattan always has my heart. I'll be back to visit.
Well, that's wonderful. So we're going to be taking callers. You ready?
I am.
Listeners, you can always contact us via social media, Facebook and Twitter, or of course, you can always call us at 800-537-5252. And we have Laura on the line. Laura?
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm great.
Where are you calling from, Laura?
I'm calling from Portland, Oregon.
Wonderful. Well, I have a very dear friend, Renee Shetler-Rossi, with me on the line. She'll be answering some of the questions, too.
Fantastic.
So what's your question, Laura?
So I cook a lot at home, and I wanted to step outside my comfort zone and experiment with pressure cookers. So I got one, and I wanted to make baked beans. So I tried this recipe that looked like it was going to be pretty good, and it was terrible. The beans came out really tough and crunchy, and I have read somewhere out there on the internet that if you add salt to your beans while they're cooking, that can make the outer shells tough. And I wondered if you had any suggestions.
I think we do. Renee, do you want to take this?
Yeah, absolutely. Laura, thanks so much for asking that question. You know, I've been hearing that very same cautionary advice about cooking beans with salt for, gosh, as long as I can recall. And I think everybody probably has. But in recent years, that notion has actually been debunked by several different food authorities, including food scientist Harold McGee, the New York Times, America's Test Kitchen. And actually, what they advise is not just adding salt to the cooking water, but adding salt to the water that you use to soak the beans in overnight before you cook them. And we're talking quite a lot of salt, about 3 tablespoons for every 4 quarts of water. What happens is the salt acts on, there's some technical science thing that goes on. It's the calcium and the magnesium ions in the outer layer of the beans. And the salt makes that layer more permeable, which then allows the water that you use to cook the beans in to permeate the beans and cook them more evenly and quickly. And so your end result is creamy, tender beans, not mealy or mushy beans.
And Laura, let me ask you a question. When you were making the recipe, were you using any kind of acid, tomatoes or anything like that, tomato paste, tomato sauce?
I can't remember exactly, but I believe that there at least was ketchup in it, which I know has vinegar, and I guess that was my secondary question. Could it have been the vinegar that did that?
Acid can make beans tough. That's something that I learned the hard way trying to make my mom's beans. So I now add the acids, tomato paste, tomato sauce, later in the cooking process.
Thank you so much. That helps a lot. I can't wait to try it out.
Great. Well, Laura, thanks for calling.
Thanks so much, Laura.
And who do we have up next? We have Jeannie on the line. Hi, Jeannie.
Hello.
Hey, Jeannie.
Hi, Renee.
Where are you calling from?
I am calling from Milwaukee.
Okay.
I wondered if you have any secrets or tips for fall-apart tender ribs, beef in stews, pot roasts. Sometimes I get amazing results and sometimes not so much.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if I'm overcooking. Can it go from tough to tender, then back to tough again?
All right. Renee, do you have that problem when you cook some beef or ribs?
You know, when I'm doing a pot roast or ribs in the oven, when I run into that type of problem, it's when I get impatient and I try to rush things. Mm-hmm. Either I'm opening the oven door a lot, or I crank the temperature up to like 325, which I find to be too hot. I really like to keep it low and slow, more like 250, 275.
Yeah. What temperature do you normally cook at or roast at?
Well, ribs, I tend to do probably 325.
Mm-hmm.
Brisket, pot roast, probably about the same, 350-ish.
Yeah, I think Renee is right. Dropping the temperature down to 250 is going to make a difference.
I will try, really, though. I've never gone 250 low. That's scary low to me.
Well, try it. It's above all safety temperatures.
Yeah.
But I bet you'll make a difference.
All right. That sounds fabulous. Thank you.
All right, Jeannie. Thanks for calling.
Bye. Thanks, Jeannie.
800-537-5252. And we have Yvette in the line.
Yvette, hi. Thanks for joining us. Where are you calling from?
Fuquay Varina, North Carolina.
And so what's your question, Yvette?
Okay, so my boyfriend's daughter lives in Czech Republic, and she's coming here for the summer, and we are going to rent a house in Charleston, and we want to forage for a meal, and I kind of wanted to get some ideas for a menu.
Okay.
First of all, I have to say, I envy you. That sounds spectacular. As you no doubt know, Charleston and the whole area around there is just so incredibly rich and diverse in terms of like wild edible everything.
Well, she's coming the second week in July. That's when we'll have the house in Charleston. And we love to fish and I love to cook and she's 10 years old and we want to just get out in the wilderness and just go for it.
All right. So, Renee, any ideas of what she could forage for?
Well, it's a little tricky to predict now exactly what's going to be in season, you know, the second week in July, just given that the weather patterns have been so wonky the past several years. But what I would suggest you do, Yvette, is start foraging at a local farmer's market. As soon as you get to Charleston, go make friends with the farmers and the foragers that you find, because you're going to get a better sense of what's in season at that moment in just a few minutes than you can with, you know, months of research online or in books.
And Yvette, that's a great idea, actually, of going to a farmer's market, because you might be able to find a farmer or a forager who you could hire to take you out to forage, because you need to be very, very careful when you forage.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, I listened to one of your shows, and it was, I think it was Hunt, Gather, Cook. And they talked about sea beans and beach peas, or maybe I'm getting that mixed up. And I was wondering if they would have anything like that in Charleston.
Well, geographically, I can't tell you that. I'm not really sure. But I know Renee's idea of going to a farmer's market and speaking to some of the locals, they would be able to really help you. Speaking to some of the local fishermen, too, they're going to be able to really help you know what to fish for and also what to forage for.
Definitely.
Because safety is always number one when it comes to foraging.
Oh, of course, yeah.
All right.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, Yvette, it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks
a
lot.
You guys
have fun.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
And we have Ralph on the line. Ralph, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Vernon Hill, Virginia.
Ah, wonderful.
Way down south in Virginia.
Way down south.
Almost in North Carolina.
Okay, well, we just had a call about North Carolina. Ralph, what is your question?
Well, I love rhubarb. In fact, I asked for a rhubarb pie for my birthday. And I also like to make a rhubarb pie. And I don't like to fuss around with it. I like it to have just plain rhubarb in it. I'm not after strawberries and things like that. I love the pure taste of rhubarb. And I love to just cook it down and use it on top of ice cream.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I just love rhubarb. My problem is, my rhubarb pies tend to be runny. Now, I know about adding tapioca or
cornstarch.
I know about adding that, that doesn't seem to matter. And then some people say, well, cook the rhubarb a little bit before you put it in the pie shell. Mm-hmm. But it's just still runny. Now, I don't really care if it's runny because I like it so much. And you could serve it in a bowl if it's just it ends up being like a rhubarb, but an apple dumpling.
Right, right.
Now, how could I get a rhubarb pie to be a little bit more firm?
Got it. Got it. Well, you know, one of the things that I think that you might be looking for, King Arthur has this. It's called Instant Clear Gel. And it basically will go in there and it solidifies the liquid. This would replace, for instance, arrowroot. It would replace cornstarch.
Uh-huh.
It would replace flour.
Uh-huh.
And I think that you'll find you're going to get a cleaner cut.
How come I don't know this?
Well, it's relatively new to the market.
I'm 85 years old. I mean, I don't know something about it.
Well, you know, that means you learn something new every day.
Yes, this is today's big lesson.
Well, and Ralph, you know, if you get a craving for rhubarb pie before your Instant Clear Gel comes in the mail,
yes.
You know, you're already doing the right thing by using cornstarch or tapioca instead of flour.
Really?
Those are stronger thickeners. Yeah, so don't revert to flour.
Don't do that.
Let me give you a couple other tricks you can try with your existing recipe.
Cool.
After you toss the rhubarb with your sugar and your tapioca or cornstarch and your cinnamon, set it aside for about an hour and wait until the rhubarb exudes some of its juices and then drain that off. And then what I like to do is I like to then reserve those juices and I simmer them down a little bit in a saucepan over low heat until they become syrupy, and then I drizzle it over the filling. I don't use all of the liquid because obviously we want to keep it from getting
too watery. You render down the liquid and
exactly.
Then pour it back in. Well, this could be the answer to the question too.
Well, Ralph, thanks for calling, and I wish you the best of luck with your pie.
Thank you very much.
Let us know how it goes.
Okay, I'll call you back.
And, you know, I know Ralph said he likes his rhubarb pure and simple, which is how I like it, too.
Right.
But actually, one trend I'm seeing a lot of in cookbooks lately is something called bluebarb pie.
Bluebarb.
Bluebarb. Everyone's familiar with strawberry rhubarb pie. Mm-hmm. This is blueberry rhubarb pie.
Interesting. Interesting.
And I have to say, we tested a recipe recently, and people are going crazy for it. It's got the tartness of rhubarb, but the sweetness of blueberries. And you don't have that watery issue because the blueberries kind of act as a natural thickener.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, it's that's wonderful. And is there what kind of topping? Is it a pie top or is it a crumble top?
You can do either. The one we tested was a crumb top, and it worked really, really well. Just the contrast in textures.
Oh, wow.
A lot of our recipe testers who made it are swearing they're going to give up strawberry rhubarb for this. And you should see the color. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous shade of crimson.
Oh, Miss Shetler, you are making me hungry now. So why don't we take another call before I start chomping on the mic? And you too can join in on the conversation with Renee and me by calling 800-537-5252. Renee, we have a question from Twitter, and it's from John. And his question is, the best way to cook salmon, I always tend to over or undercook it. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, salmon's so versatile. You can cook it on the grill, you can smoke it, you can poach it, which I think you've mentioned to me in the past that you've done.
Yeah, I like poaching it.
Okay, I personally like a little texture on my food, so I like to sear it in a hot skillet first and transfer it to the oven. I just grab a cast iron skillet, I heat it over medium high heat until it's hot but not smoking, slick it with a little oil, and then I put the salmon in, let it cook maybe about 3 to 5 minutes until it's maybe about halfway done. You'll see, you know, the color change in the fillet on the side.
Right.
And then I slide it into a preheated 400-degree oven so that it can cook for maybe 3 to 5 more minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It'll give you a nice crisp crust.
We do ours in a fish poacher, and all we do is we put the fillet on it, and we put in some herbs, a lot of times lemon, sometimes fennel, different herbs in there, and some wine and some water. And we just poach it very gently. I think one of the things that John could do is always make sure he's checking and just kind of poking very gently into the flake of the fish to see how well it's cooked. That way, it would prevent it being either under or overcooked. Because I think what he's actually talking about is not so much a technique for cooking it, but knowing when it's done.
When it's done.
Exactly.
And, you know, one kind of road mark for when you've gone too far is when you get those white curds coming out of the salmon.
Yeah.
Then you know
kinda
you've either overcooked
top.
It. Yeah, right? Like cottage cheese. You know you've either cooked it for too long or at too hot a temperature.
Too high of a temperature.
When that happens.
So, John, from Twitter, I hope that answers your question. There's two different techniques there, but I think most important is just keep on checking the fish while it's cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Renee, it's been so wonderful having you on the show, and I have to say goodbye to you, unfortunately.
I know, but thank you. It was lovely, and you can call me anytime.
I know. I can. And, you know, you can call the Splendid Table at 800-537-5252, and we thank you all for calling in with your questions. But sadly, we are out of time. So thank you so much for joining me. I had a blast again, and Miss Casper will be back next week. You can find all the recipes you heard about on today's show and information on our guests and their books at splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, subscribe to the weekly Splendid Table podcast at iTunes, and register for the monthly giveaway. You'll find it all at splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lutke. Sally Swift is the managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm David Leet, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.